Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 232. Hooray, palindromes. I am Vincent Diamante, and I'm currently dealing with all sorts of crap in my studio. I have a bunch of broken iwis, a bunch of broken electric wind instruments, which is really hampering my ability to actually track MIDI. Super frustrating. And that is something I really hope that none of you guys actually have to deal with right now. But, well, yeah, I hope not. Alex, hopefully you're not dealing with any issues like I'm dealing with right now.
I am not dealing with broken iwis, no. Actually, I don't even have an iwi. But everything's functioning pretty well, except for Reaper yesterday, which was a bit buggy for me, which is a first, because I don't think I've ever had Reaper be buggy for me. And if naturally it happens on a very, very tight deadline where I was racing through to do some sound effects work. And yes, that's probably the extent of stuff that's broken over here. No iwis, I'm afraid.
Okay, no iwis, but Reaper being buggy, that's a really strange thing for me. I mean, I'm a Reaper user, and usually it's pretty rock solid for me. Mike, you don't deal with Reaper, right?
I don't, and I can only really aspire to have a broken iwi or the talent to play a non-broken iwi. What I do have is a broken controller keyboard, my beloved Icon keyboard that I spent so long searching for, scouring reviews to find a keyboard controller that had just the right height and other physical parameters to fit in my setup, and 2 months went by and it broke. Now, one of the advantages of living in LA is that if your musical gear breaks, chances are that you're a 20-minute drive away from the manufacturer, and you can just wheel on over and have them swap out a new circuit board or replace it. And in the past, I've availed myself of this. I had another piece of gear. I've had gear break on a couple of occasions, and I've been able to solve the problem with just 2 hours of driving both ways and being nice to somebody. And sure enough, in this case, it seemed like this was one of those situations, because the official service for Icon was in Sun Valley, which is a quick drive away. But further investigation revealed they had just moved to, I believe, Tennessee. So was a bit of a problem. Fortunately, I had my emergency backup keyboard, and I didn't lose any work time. But it does speak to the importance of having a supplementary emergency controller on hand, or perhaps a friend from whom you can borrow one in a pinch.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Quick note, I have actually an 88-key Icon keyboard, and we're pretty close to each other, you know, relatively speaking. Give me a quick reminder. I could throw that in the trunk the next time I'm up there in your neighborhood.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, but speaking of friends from whom you could borrow controllers, we actually have someone else on this call today. That's right. The threesome is actually a foursome right now. Jeff, this is Jeff Broadbent. You are not in SoCal right now, are you?
No, unfortunately, the 2 hour drive might be a 2 hour plane trip, but but yeah, if I was there, I'd be happy to help out. I've been in that situation myself, too, and I second Mike's advice of having a secondary MIDI keyboard on hand. I've been there, too, and it always helps to have that to swap out, so for sure.
Yeah, Jeff, it's really nice to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm really excited to talk today, and yeah, seems like a very fun podcast you guys have going.
Yeah, it's we like to think it's pretty fun. We try to take it pretty relaxed, just talk about random stuff that is going on in life,
in career, or maybe it's just games that we're playing. This is the first time on the show for you. So I think it would be great if you could introduce us to who you are as a composer. You know, not obviously not just games, but also in other media. But, you know, tell us a little bit about Jeff, the music composer.
Yeah, for sure. Basically, just starting from the beginning, my original instruments were piano, first classically trained, starting at 8, and classical saxophone also was a main instrument that I played. As a teenager, I got really into jazz improvisation. I had a jazz piano teacher who was a music theory major and had played in jazz bands professionally and things like that. So the process of improvising and being coached from him on improvising and music theory is really what sparked my interest in composition, because I found that I just loved kind of almost the cerebral nature of music theory and things like that. So anyways, that led into a segue into studying music in college. I got a master's degree in traditional composition, and from UCLA, specifically studied film, TV, and game scoring. And that later led into a great interest in video game music. Growing up, I always loved video games. I grew up in the Nintendo Entertainment time, and also a lot of games I played were the 8-bit systems and also the 16-bit systems. I remember the first time I heard live orchestra music or recorded orchestra music in a game was a game called Panzer Dragoon on the Sega Saturn. And I remember, I don't know if you've played that one, but I remember I was 15 and I remember hearing that and I was like, my gosh, this is the whole nother level. It's not just the sound chips and things like that, but it was just an amazing experience. And so I really knew I wanted to score for video games probably when I was, 15 years old and that kind of thing. It was always a dream that I had.
That's awesome.
Yeah. When I was at UCLA, I had a video game scoring teacher named Lenny Moore. And he worked on a bunch of different games like Star Wars, Knights of the Old Republic, and other things. And he had such a passion for game audio and was such a good teacher that really further solidified my desire to pursue music for video games. So I've composed for a bunch of mediums in addition to video games. I've done a lot of trailer work, both for film trailers and things used in television promos and custom scoring video game trailers. Some film work I've done, not a lot, but some, and a lot of music that's been placed in various TV shows and things like that. So I've been fortunate to compose for a variety of different mediums. Haven't dabbled much in the concert music arena. Not that I'd not like to. I actually love concert music and art music, but just due to time constraints, haven't done so much of that. But yeah, just a lot of great experiences over the years.
That's really awesome. I'm just doing a little bit of math in my head, and it's like, oh, okay, you were 15 when you first experienced specifically that particular experience that you mentioned with the soundtrack for Panzer Dragoon. Is that about right?
Yeah, and it's easy for me to remember because I was born in 1980, so it must have been 95. I think the Saturn maybe came out in 95 or 94. I can't remember exactly, but yeah. I think I was a sophomore in high school, so.
It's funny how we all sort of have that moment, don't we? We all sort of have that moment. Usually it's around the ages of 13, 14, or 15 where you're either playing a game or you're watching TV or you're at a concert or something like that, and something triggers inside you and yes, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. I want to make music like that. I can specifically remember that moment for myself. Did you, Vince and Mike, did you both have a moment like that when you suddenly decided, this is it, this is what I want to do?
Well, for me, I think it was a evolution, because I was first drawn into film music by John Williams and James Horner and kind of the three J's of the 80s. With game music, it was more of a gradual creep as game audio matured and the artistic expressiveness of game music became more sophisticated as a result. So for me, I think the latter was were games on the Amiga, where we were starting to hear digital audio incorporated in a useful way, and we're starting to see really powerful music experiences in games that didn't require a lot of putting up with sine waves and very primitive synthesis. How about you, Alex?
Yeah, for me, it was Double Dragon 2 on the Commodore Amiga had a soundtrack by a demo scene musician called Uncle Tom, and was just epic. And I listen to it now, and I still think it's epic. I remember when I must have been like 11 or so, I think, and went into my brother's room and he said, check this out. Check out this game that I've just downloaded from some shady BBS in Norway somewhere. And because that's the sad story of the Commodore Amiga, I suppose. But that and also Turrican 2 by... the name escapes me just at this moment. It is... How can I forget?
Oh, God, yeah. Turrican. It's Turrican. It's...
Hulsbeck. Hulsbeck, that's it. Yeah. Anyway, so those two Amiga soundtracks were that just sort of flipped a switch inside my head. It's like, yes, I want to do that. That's awesome. Well, how about you, Vince? Did you have that moment when you were in your teens, early teens, perhaps, or around that period?
Not really. Actually, I wanted to get into game music earlier, but it was largely in a similar way to Mike, but not quite. How shall I explain? I loved film music. I was such a sucker for film music, especially John Williams, Alan Silvestri. I just loved that stuff. And I loved video games too. I actually had a cousin who had a Commodore 64, but he always played with that Commodore 64 hooked up to his monitor with no speaker. So I played all of these classic games, things from the Electronic Arts catalog, things like Sky Fox, Hard Hat Mac, classics, or like Epics. Epics was a fantastic purveyor of games back in the 80s. Breakdance and Summer and Winter Games and so much stuff. Mm-hmm. But I played them all totally mute. And so in my head, I thought, wow, why are games these things that don't have any audio to it? and it wasn't until later that I realized that, oh my God, I was so deprived of all the legitimately great feats of audio design and music programming that were on the Commodore 64. So, that's kind of how that went.
Jeff, in your career, because you've had an interesting sort of cross-section between linear music composing for film and trailers and work like that, as well as obviously all of the accolades and the achievements that you've got in game audio as a game composer, do you have a favorite? Do you prefer doing game music, or do you prefer doing music to picture, or how do you feel about that?
I don't think I necessarily have a favorite. I mean, I think that the overarching thing that I hope is that the music will touch the audience member. Like the experience I mentioned for myself when I was a youth, playing a game or watching a film. Like you guys, I loved the classic composers, Horner and Williams and Goldsmith and so on. I don't think I have a favorite medium. I think that I have a wide variety of interests, even in music styles. I've composed a lot of orchestral music, but also some scores that are purely electronic and things. And I think the unifying aspect between them all is just a hope that the music supports the story and connects the audience emotionally to it. Because I mean, I'll still go to the theater and sit and watch a film and just immerse myself in that. And I love that experience. And for me, that's kind of the ultimate, just to impart that to somebody else.
Mm. It's interesting to have the privilege of speaking to a game audio veteran such as yourself with a broad cross-section of genres and styles in your portfolio. Where do you stand on the issue for young composers getting into game audio on the issue of generalization versus specialization? Do you generally advise that young people specialize in a certain style, or that they generalize such as you have across a broad range of different genres?
Right. Yeah, that's a very good question. And I've a lot of young composers or folks in college have asked me that very same question. Originally, when I started out, I actually did a bit more of a generalist approach. And the reason for that is that, first of all, I was trained primarily in classical orchestration, so I was very comfortable with that. And on my own, I learned more of the usage of electronics and synthesizers and things like that. But still, when I started out fresh out of college, I tried to diversify a lot because I wanted to have essentially a greater opportunity of working with folks, knowing that I wouldn't know where the initial projects came from. So initially on purpose, I diversified, though I did have somewhat of a specialist. And the specialist for me at that time was a hybrid orchestral stuff because I knew how to work with an orchestra, but I also enjoyed the blending of synths and so on with it. As time goes on, I'm sure we're all aware, you tend to gravitate, not necessarily always by choice, but by the kind of credits you accumulate into more specific genres. And for me, the bit more focus evolved naturally as my career progressed. But starting out purposefully, I tried to have a bit more of a broader scope. I think there can be pros and cons to either approach. I think a pro to having a wider scope or trying to gain skill in different music styles is you can potentially be considered for a wider variety of projects. The con, though, is if the quality is not sufficiently high, that'll be evident. So I do think that quality is always necessary, but in the beginning, if possible, diversification helps.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I guess I'm on the other side of the table there because I think that nowadays there are just so many people doing such good music all over the world. There's just, you know, we're in a wonderful time for the art of music for video games. And I personally feel like the advice that I would like to give to younger upcoming people in game audio is that, you know, When you think about specific genres, as a simple example, like I specialize primarily in electronic music, and if somebody asked me to write an orchestral score, if I had that opportunity, it feels to me like totally overwhelming. I wouldn't have any idea where to start. There's so much to know. There's so much to learn. In that kind of situation, I would, you know, much more gladly somehow arrange for. Usually it's Mike, but somehow arrange for somebody else who's far more experienced and more sort of established in that genre and in that realm to take the reins on something like that. Because it just feels like there's so many people doing such good music all over the world. As a generalist, it's just really, really hard, I would imagine, to, you know, in a sense, to compete with
yes.
specialists.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and times have changed too. Meaning, it's been almost 20 years, not quite, around maybe 15 years or so since I graduated from college. So, yeah, it is correct that there's likely more people creating music nowadays, and I think a general principle is the more the quantity, the greater the need for differentiation, meaning distinctness and uniqueness, and what you're describing definitely. Does that. And I think that people have to think about what their training and background is and really the best way to position yourself, emphasizing your strengths and things like that.
Yeah.
One other thought on that, and maybe you guys can chime in if you have any thoughts on this, is that I have such a wide interest in a variety of music styles that sometimes I want to branch out more, but it's a bit difficult. An example of that is in 2018, or I believe it came out in 2019, I scored a racing video game called Grid, and it had a lot of, it was basically a pure synthesizer score with some modern drums and effects and things. And I loved working on that because prior to that, so much of what I had done was either orchestral or orchestral hybrid. But it's a little tricky to not get pigeonholed into certain genres based on your credits. So I don't know if any of you had any experience of that, of really enjoying a certain genre, but simply not having as many opportunities for it, I guess I would say.
Mike, Vince?
First of all, I actually totally forgot that you did Grid, but I'm just thinking, oh, I actually played Grid rather recently, and I thought, oh, that was pretty good. I got it on Stadia, and I thought, I'm a sucker for all racing games, and I mean, that was a Codemasters game, right? I actually generally love their stuff. So I played the heck out of that, and I thought it really sounded good as well. So just wanted to throw out some kudos there. When it comes to getting pigeonholed, I kind of have gotten that myself since I've, I've spent most of my career working with a single game company. And so the sound that I've done just for that company is really become my sound, even though it's not necessarily the thing that I want to do. I feel like it's actually been a struggle doing stuff for other projects, whether they come to me or I go to them, suggesting something that is not this big monolith of a project that's really defined me for the last decade. I recently made the decision to go freelance. And I've been talking to a few people here and there. And all across the board, there is an assumption made about what is the sound that I would bring to their project, even if it's not necessarily the thing that they have in mind.
Right.
Sorry. Actually, sorry about that, Vince. I'm saying sorry just because the last, when we last collaborated on the soundtrack deals, that was way, way different from, you know, the stuff that you'd done for that game company.
Which is great. Don't say sorry. I thought it was awesome because, like, oh man, I need to flex these muscles, right? I love doing that.
Well, speaking as someone who doesn't have a dog in this particular race, I enjoyed both of your contributions to that particular game. So that was fun to listen to. Jeff, since we're on the topic of the earlier phases of your career, you mentioned you had a traditional classical music upbringing, and then you went to UCLA for their extension program in film and media scoring. How did you make that transition from the classical world, the traditional world, into the much more focused commercial side of composition? How did you approach that problem, and what steps did you take to kick off your career?
Yeah, great question. And something that I thought so much about, it was almost a paradox of sorts in the final years of college. The bridge between purely studying my studies in composition were actually mainly avant-garde music. The professors highly emphasized, and it was a lot of non-traditional music, meaning atonal or that kind of thing, including what I was writing. I mean, my master's thesis piece for wind ensemble was not tonal and was very complicated and that kind of thing. So basically, when I was in high school, I was always kind of doing two different things. I was in studying and writing music academically. It was all along those lines. But at the same time, I was studying John Williams scores on my own, meaning analyzing them, and writing a lot of music pretty much every week or so on my own that was in styles that were more suitable for film or video games or that kind of thing. So along the way during the education process, I was kind of feeding both beasts, so to speak. I realized, of course, that while you always want to bring your own artistic voice to the music, that at the same time, being a composer for media, some adaptation is required, meaning you have to be able to sit down with a project and think about the needs of the project and then break that down, distill that into what the musical components will be of the score that you're doing. So, which is different than a pure concert music composing mindset or a pure artist mindset, which is kind of a singular world, just how am I going to express my idea? So I really got into the mindset of a collaborative mindset and working on some smaller video game projects early on, or working with some music libraries or some film directors in the final years of schooling helped me do that. So I think the transition is largely a mindset transition, and it's a transition of project first and music supports the project. And whenever I work with folks now, like today, for example, I'm doing some mix revisions, meaning they'll tell me to fix this and tell me to fix that. I always take the mindset of I'm here to support the project. And I think that that's always helped and has served me well, because I always tell people that I work with that I will put their project first, and my efforts will always be to that end. So they never have to feel like they're fighting with me that I have this idea and they have that idea. Yes, we'll share ideas, but at the end of the day, it's all about the game, and that is my goal, or the film, or the television show. So those are some mindset elements that have helped me a lot.
When you're coming from a background of contemporary, you know, I'll call it academic music, it's such an interesting contrast in attitude, because, you know, the mindset of we'll call them concert composers, really since the 19th century has been, it's all about you, and hopefully the audience will appreciate your genius.
Yes.
And certainly, you know, if you're working in with atonal music in some of the explosion of styles that characterized like 1920 to present day in academia, there's a feeling of not even trying to reach an audience often. You know, it's like, yes, I'm going to explore this esoteric technique, and I'm going to push on this frontier. And to quote this famous John Cage article, you know, who cares if you listen? So
yes,
exactly. When you're talking about the mindset change, I think it's worth appreciating what a shift that is if you're coming from the world of atonal concert composition. It might not seem like such a big deal for listeners who kind of started out wanting to do media music and that being their world, but there really are different approaches.
Right. And yeah, the thing you mentioned about John Cage is absolutely correct. I mean, it is so different. And the thing now is that I'm very used to the composing for media mindset, but thinking back, it was a huge mindset shift. And you're right, a lot of art music is, I guess you could call it art for art's sake, meaning damned be the audience. It's about the, as you said, the innovation, and it's an end unto itself, meaning the score and the piece of music is meant to explore, it's meant to push boundaries. I still love that to a certain degree. I mean, I love going to art museums when I travel and going in, and I love all kinds of art. I love modern art too, and seeing how artists are in the visual world are doing that with, you know, visual art. To me, it's fascinating, and I love it. And I always think that art is something that, meaning even art for art's sake, is something that should be supported and pursued, because it's what pushes a lot of the boundaries and the progress of music that then filters into music for media and the entertainment industry and things like that. But as far as the practicality of working in the entertainment industry, I think that there has to be a balance, because if there's too much of the solo artist mindset, you're not going to collaborate very well, and the music may be too esoteric for the needs of the project. Though at the same time, if you become too much of a business mindset, then the music will lack creativity. So it's a real balance. But yeah, I think it's the challenge I can very much relate to, because I spent 6 years essentially studying and writing that kind of academic music. And that ain't necessarily the mindset approach that's going to be successful in the entertainment world. You have to bridge the two.
I've always said that composing atonally is kind of like programming in assembly language. You should learn how to do it so you appreciate that you never have to do it. To have that technical skill is very useful. By the way, a point of a factual correction, it was not John Cage who wrote that article. It was Milton Babbitt.
Oh, okay.
Didn't want to impugn Mr. Cage for that.
Right.
If you look at your
He wrote the 433 or whatever, which was silence. So
yeah, the infamous sense. I don't know whether or not it's music is the entire philosophical proposition that piece was trying to establish. But yeah, he was definitely on the forefront of the avant-garde. And I think if you tried to submit a blank wave file to a game score and say, you know, you're not appreciating the silence, you probably would not get
I'm gonna
a good
try
response.
That. No, I'm just kidding. That would be very fun.
If you were to look at your Jeff, you look at your CV, there are a lot of very recognizable brands. You know, there's Assassin's Creed, there's Avengers, Call of Duty, Final Fantasy. What point in your career were you able to make that valence leap from where you started to working with such mainstream properties and presumably the caretakers of those properties who are probably very, very picky and careful about music?
Right. Yeah, that's another great question. I've always, one of the strengths I think I have, though I have many weaknesses, but one of the strengths I have is that I can be fairly, I can try to get into the creative mindset and the artistic mindset, though I also love business and I love kind of having an analytical mindset and a strategic approach and things like that. Early on when I started my first, this was back in the kind of before mobile games got big, back when a lot of the, it was primarily kind of console games or indie games, that kind of thing. Early on, my goal was to score a console game initially, and kind of a strategy I had, because I've never worked for a game company, I've always been freelance. Early on, my strategy was to work with some independent game developers to get some credits and things like that, so I did that. There were smaller projects and things like that, but after that, my goal was primarily to try and score a console game. So I spent a lot of time, of course, as we all know, going to conferences and meeting the people that hire composers for these, and also reaching out to companies to that specific end. And the first project that kind of paved the way for me was a movie game. It was a Transformers movie game. It was called Transformers Dark of the Moon. It was like the third movie game, and it was made by Activision. Luckily, at the time, I demoed on the project, and I think there were maybe three other composers demoing on it. The music style was very close to a music style that I was making for a trailer music or a production music house, so I was really familiar with doing that style, and it synced well with it. But I use that as an example because my goal was to score for a console video game, so I was specifically trying to pursue that. As far as the other larger kind of name known projects you mentioned, many of them came from working with folks prior on a smaller project, and then when the other project came along that they invited me to work with them on it. For example, the Assassin's Creed one, which was, it was still a bit of a smaller project. It was a mobile Assassin's Creed game. That was with a Ubisoft studio that used to be called Blue Byte in Germany. And I worked with their audio director on a video game called Champions of Antaria, which was its own IP. And later, because we enjoyed the working process a lot, he invited me to work on the Assassins project with him. The Call of Duty one was similar. I had worked with a company called Tencent for a long time, doing music for all kinds of games that they had. And when I found out they were working on that, I told them that I loved that game series. And I do. I mean, I played it back when it was on the PlayStation 2 and so on. And so they kind of similar thing. They invited me to work on that. The Final Fantasy thing, oddly enough, was a bit happenstance, but also a bit persistence on my end. At one GDC, I'm forgetting which one it was. It may have been 2016 or so, maybe 2017. I went to a Final Fantasy talk. Final Fantasy music I've loved too. That Final Fantasy III on the Super Nintendo was another big inspiration for me, you know, listening to that. So that was always ingrained in my psyche. So I went to their talk. It was actually a programmer who talked about implementing boss music in Final Fantasy. I think it was 15, Final Fantasy 15. So I went up to him afterwards and we kept in touch after that. On occasion, I'd traveled to Asia to visit some game studios I work with and so on. So one of the times I stopped over in Tokyo and just said, hey guys, I'm in town. Maybe we can hang out. And they actually invited me to lunch and that kind of thing. Got to meet him in the Square Enix office. And probably 2 years later after that, they said some music needs came up and I composed a bit for it. So that was a really long process of meeting somebody and just keeping in touch and trying to keep the relationship going, though it can be difficult when you're overseas and things. But that's kind of how that went. So it's always a lot of different things, but I always try to keep in touch with people and meet new people. And it's hard when you get busy to keep in touch with people. That's always the challenge, especially when we're working remotely and things like that. But I always make the effort. You know, I try to go to GDC every year. I just went to Game SoundCon recently and saw a bunch of familiar faces and met some new people. So it's, and when I know people are working on an awesome thing, I'll let them know that I love it. I mean, another project that I worked on, they were a bit smaller spinoffs, but for the Resident Evil series, I mean, I've loved that game. That was another, just as a gamer, a series that I love. And I remember when some of the folks from Japan went to GDC a few years ago and they were talking about Resident Evil 7. You know, I went up to them and told them, look, I love the game, and I do. I played it and played nearly all the Resident Evil games and just tried to keep in touch with them and things like that. So anyway, that's probably a long-winded answer, but that's kind of how I go about things. But
no, that's great. And yeah. I think there's some the interesting touchback to the very first topic we approached at the start of this talk, that of having musical diversity versus musical focus. And it's interesting to note how, you know, ultimately, if you've got a passion or a artistic, again, you know, somewhere where you're most artistically at home, your career is going to naturally be pulled in that direction, or it allows you to advance your career in that direction. In your case, you know, your fandom of certain games turned into a practical career asset because you were able to effectively pre-qualify yourself to work on certain projects. So there's, you know, there's as much as there is to be said for a well-rounded resume, the things that you love, and I'm speaking to everyone, you know, in our audience right now, the things that you love are ultimately artistic assets, and it's possible to translate that into career progress.
Yeah, I would agree entirely. I think that when you find what you're passionate about, the energy is limitless towards it. Meaning, and I've found that when, I'm sure we all have, when you're working late nights or working on the weekends or whatever, if the passion's there, it's not a challenge. I mean, it's going to be hard, but you're doing it because you love it. And, you know, I love video games and I love music. That's the truth. And I remember saying once in an interview years ago that if I didn't get paid for it, I'd still do it. And the reason is that I like it. So it's just the truth, because that to me is the raw ingredient. When the passion's there, the effort will be there. And you do have to find inwardly what your muse is, as they say, and follow that. I think that if there's any core to any of this, it's probably that.
And that also, that enthusiasm definitely translates and is definitely something that other people will notice when you're talking about it as well, right? You know, if you love Resident Evil, I'm sure that the people just did their talk at GDC and some person's come up to chat to them and he looks really enthusiastic about Resident Evil and he's a composer, right? And he, you know, he's done this and he's done that and he just loves Resident Evil. That enthusiasm definitely comes across and will be something that's certainly memorable. Yes. And, you know, clearly from a business entrepreneurial point of view, very, very effective as well.
Right, totally. I mean, there's an old... Well, maybe it doesn't tie into this, but there's an old saying that I always liked that was, people hate to be sold to but love to buy. And part of what that means is that people can smell insincerity, meaning if you're just going to lather it on, guess what? They're going to know, and it's going to be off-putting. But if you do truly love something, and guess what? It's going to show too. Yeah. And that's why I think that my advice to people, and even as my kids grow up and things like that, is find what you're passionate about and pursue that. You got to put that first, and the other things are going to be there if you do that. And I really think that the people that excel the most in any industry are the people that have done that, because that'll give you the limitless energy and the drive to just keep going and going and going.
Yeah, sure.
Everyone has to deal with deadlines and the grind and fatigue. That's almost always universal to, you know, any game scoring project, or, you know, really any kind of collaborative project. But as you say, Jeff, if you're fueled by love for what you're doing, it gives you that little extra endurance and motivation to get through with it and to keep doing good work, even though you're tired. And I think that's the real trick.
Exactly. Mm. Yep.
So I'm really the show clock is ticking on, but I'm really eager to talk some gear as well, because I find it fascinating that in your position, you know, having done stuff on the, you know, more the electronic side, but also on the hybrid orchestral side and the orchestral side as well, I'm really curious to hear about your setup, like in terms of hardware synths or software synths or DAWs, right, or your process and workflow. Let's talk shop.
Yeah, totally. So DAW is Logic. I started using Logic in college and just never departed from it because I'm so comfortable with it. I've always been of the mindset that it's not so much the DAW, I mean, obviously they can have their slight differences, but it's the components that filter into the end sonic result, meaning the instruments you use, the plugins you use, the mixing techniques you use. So, you know, I'm on Logic Pro and I'm not even on the latest version. I've been on an older version for a while, but I'll constantly buy new mixing plugins and new sample libraries because to me, those are the raw ingredients. Just a funny kind of analogy is I like See's Candy a lot. It's this candy company that makes chocolates, and one of their bylines is something like the finest quality ingredients, blah, blah, blah. Well, you got to start with the finest quality ingredients. So I try to spend my studio expansion efforts and things like that. For soft, as far as virtual instrument libraries, I have tons of them. I'm on the mailing lists of them. So whenever a new one comes out, I'll listen to the walkthrough. I always listen to the walkthrough video because I want to compare it to the ones I already have and see if it really sounds better or just different. A lot of the orchestral libraries are different and nuanced, but they're not necessarily heads above better than the other guy.
Right.
So I'll always analyze them, and I keep if it's something I know I'll need, I'll usually buy it right away, especially if it's on sale. If it's something that I might need, I keep a master list of plugins and virtual instruments that are by category. So whenever I work on a new project, I can go to that list and by category look for new gear that I might want to get. So yeah, soft synth, same thing. I love the soft synths by, I'm guessing it's pronounced Yuhe. It's U-H-E. I love their soft synths because to me they capture the analog flavor better than almost anybody.
Absolutely.
On the grid score, because they wanted the music style for that changed, but they wanted a bit of a synthwave sound. I used a ton of Diva on that. Just a ton of that. And buying many preset libraries and so on, because I like to tweak stuff, but I also, because deadlines are an issue, I like to get the sound packs that are created by a lot of skilled sound designers. So I'd purchase a bunch of different sound packs that sounded right and then just be able to hunt through really quickly to find a suitable sound, then tweak it to the needs.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit more of a find the preset and tweak it guy rather than a build everything from scratch guy. Cause I recognize that a lot of these synth sound designers, their talents probably exceed my own in synthesis. So I'll lean upon that and then tweak it in the mix and that kind of thing.
Cool.
As far as hardware synths, I actually don't use too many, primarily because nowadays, at least to my ear, the soft synths are of such high quality. And there's the added benefit of having the ability to save the presets and things like that for recall, which is obviously a practical consideration. Same thing with the mixing plugins. I have all kinds of plugins from Waves, Slate Digital, and things like that. If the project budget allows, we'll often, in particular if it's orchestral, we'll have an external mixer do it sometimes. But for myself, on other things, I'm pretty much using in the box plugins for mixing. A lot of, as I said, a lot of Waves, Slate Digital stuff,
Fab Jeff, filter. If we said, let's see, EQ, compressor, reverb, let's see,
right.
What is it? Pick one. What's in your favorites list?
Yeah. Well, picking one, EQ, I'd go with the Fab filter. It's just so easy to use in surgical and things like that. Reverb, if it's algorithmic, that's kind of a toss-up. I love the Valhalla stuff for algorithmic, though I have yet to download in the Seventh Heaven one. I've heard great things about that, so it's probably next to try. For convolution reverb, I still use Altiverb a lot. And I tend to use convolution reverb on orchestral material more, and algorithmic reverb I will use on synthesizers and solo instruments more often because it simply gives a greater sonic shaping possibilities with the reverb tail and things like that. Whereas for the orchestral stuff, you want it to sound like it's in a specific room. So I like the hall modeling a lot. Compressors. I use a Slate Digital has a virtual mixing rack that has a bunch of compressors in it. I tend to use those a lot. I'll use different ones depending on if I want a harder compressor or a more subtle one. I use tape emulation and harmonic enhancement a fair amount too. And I'll use Isotope stuff for that and also Slate Digital. And I know Waves has some things like that too. A bunch of them do, but I'll often put it just depends on the genre, but I'll put, if an instrument needs a bit more weight or a bit more prominence, I'll add those to it. I'll often put do a bit of mix bus processing too. Where I'll put very slight amounts of harmonic enhancement on the mix bus or EQ enhancement or things like that. It just gives a bit more air to the sound and makes it sound a little more natural, in particular if there aren't live instruments, meaning if I'm having to use all virtual instruments, that I've found is very helpful. What other plugins? We did EQ, we did reverb.
Saturation?
Saturations. Same thing. I've been using the Slate Digital things a lot with their, again, the virtual mix rack. They have a bunch of that there. I know there's other ones too I need to get into. Waves make some good ones, and the UAD, of course, is very high quality.
That's really, go ahead.
Oh, and then I guess after that, it's just special effect plugins, which are kind of on an as-needed basis, you know, the delays and the distortions and things like that.
Mm. It's interesting, actually, you know, a lot of us who work in the box primarily, you know, where it's often tinged with a certain sense of guilt about the amount of plugins that we that we amass, you know, and you get this kind of what's the expression? Is it choice paralysis? No.
Analysis paralysis.
Exactly.
Basically, where you could just got, there's so many options, and you just sit there looking at your plugin list, thinking, I don't know which one of these I'm going to use today.
Yes.
But do you like from what you were describing there earlier on, where you mentioned that, like, you know, these are the raw ingredients of what we're cooking up here. The, you know, the sound libraries and the plugins and this is the raw stuff, and that you mentioned that you have a list of, you know, like a wish list perhaps that, of things that you might pick up when it goes on sale. Do you see these kinds of purchases as being, where do you emotionally put yourself when it comes to this kind of accumulation of tools?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I'll approach it from two angles. The first is buying new gear, and the second one is using the existing plugins. I tend to be very methodical in the choice process. For buying new gear, if it's something I know I will use, meaning there's 100% certainty I'll use it and it's on sale, it's usually decision done. I'm getting it and I'm probably getting it right now. If it's something I might use in the future, meaning the quality is sufficiently high and there's a fair likelihood I might need it in the future, it goes on the wish list. So that's basically what I do. I don't like to buy things that maybe I'll use in the future because they'll always be there in the future. Just log in and download them. But if it's on sale, and I know that I will use it, well, I'll take advantage of the sale then.
Right.
For the usage of plugins, the analysis by paralysis thing is very real. And I'm not formally trained as a mixing engineer, but and because of that, I'll often watch YouTube tutorials and read books and other things to gain greater knowledge at that. For mixing, I think you have to approach it from a fairly methodical standpoint. One thing that I read that makes a lot of sense is that mixers will often do a static mix first, meaning not worry about the plugins so much. They'll just set, it's about the volume levels and the panning, getting it to sound balanced. And I find that on the stuff that I do, and talking with other composers too, so much of the time is spent simply volume automating, meaning getting the balance right. In particular with virtual instruments, because they're already going to sound pretty good because they've been mixed by the product manufacturer. You know, they are enhancing them somewhat on their end. And getting things to sit in the mix is the first thing. So I'll spend a lot of time simply doing a static mix, which is volume automation and panning and things like that. After that, or sometimes at the same time, though again, I'll think of it in a methodical process, I tend to think of plugins in terms of categories, kind of like your question to me. I'll think of them in terms of dynamic processing, meaning compressors or expanders, though I very rarely use those. I'll think of them in terms of space, meaning reverb, and sometimes I'll think of delay as part of that too, because it, you know, affects the tail end of the sound. And I'll think of it in terms of sonic shaping by EQ, which could be corrective EQ or getting something to poke out of the mix more. And then after that, I'll think in terms of sonic shaping or creative plugins such as, you know, choruses or distortion or kind of things where you would automate the effect in real time to give sonic transformation or enhancement to the sound. So for me, I think the analysis by paralysis comes when you're looking at the branches and not the root. Mm. Meaning, here are all the leaves. Okay. But the tree only has one root and it has maybe four branches. The rest are just leaves. So I tend to think of it in this categorized way, which allows me to be more efficient and more, I guess, objective in the choice. So I'm not just running through a million plugins. It's like, does it even need anything, first of all? Okay, it needs a compressor. Okay. What is the purpose of the compressor? It's to even out the volume performance of the live soloist. Okay. Now, which one will do that? So right. It's always a tiered approach, or almost almost like a decision tree, kind of.
Yeah, I unfortunately I've always purchased plugins and virtual instruments and stuff, always with that sense of guilt that, like, yeah, do I really need this? No, probably not. But hey, it's fun.
Yeah. Oh, I've done that. I've done that to agree too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But oddly, it's something that. And I guess I need to be better at remembering recent ones I've gotten. Sometimes I've gotten ones and I've forgotten they're there.
Right.
I mean, because you'll fall back to your go-tos because you used them before, especially when the deadlines are tight.
Yeah.
But that's a tricky one.
I'm increasingly, perhaps as I get, I don't know, older and more mature as a music producer, I'm actually finding myself more often than not using anything anymore. It goes back to what you were saying just a moment there about making the static mix and using basically volume and pan.
Yes.
And like in often, because I work primarily with synths and with electronic music, you know, you have access to the source. It's right there,
right.
You know. So rather than, you know, putting a synth on there and then feeling compelled to add a compressor and an EQ because that's what you do, just adjust the synthesizer so you don't need to do that, or just use basic pan and volume techniques. And yeah, more often than not, these days I'm coming to the end of my tracking process and listening and thinking, actually, the mixing's kind of already done here. I don't really need to do that much. And that's for somebody who also enjoys the process of shopping for these kinds of tools. That's kind of bittersweet.
Oh yeah. No, I can relate to that. One other tip that I remember from a video or whatever by a mixing engineer that helps me sometimes is closing my eyes when I listen to the mix. Maybe it's an old trick that a lot of people know, but it's surprising how differently you'll experience it. I usually, when I make an adjustment, I will look away from the screen or do something to force my ears and not my eyes to hear it. Because at the end of the day, all that matters is what it sounds like. Nobody's going to care what plugin I used or what thing I put on it or what fancy plugin chain. Nobody's going to care about any of that. All that they're going to care about is what does the wave file sound like. And so for me, closing my eyes when listening to the mix and then maybe even writing down mix notes can help. Or I'll do things to quickly refresh my ears, like I'll switch over to the headphones. Now switch back to the monitors. The problem is maintaining objectivity when mixing, and the eyes can be deceiving, and too much conditioning of the ears without a change in environment can also be deceiving.
Absolutely.
I find it useful to go to a different location and listen to my music. So it's sort of a variation on the idea of closing your eyes, because I separate myself from the ability to make any changes. You know, I go to a room where my studio is not.
There you go.
And just like you say, I'll start listening from a perspective of someone who's not me, and I'll start typing mix notes. and then send them to my machine in the studio. So it's a really good tactic.
Yeah, that's smart. That's the same thing. Force yourself to be a listener.
Yeah. Definitely. Listening room two for me is my car. that works very well for that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And learning, and I think the better we get at doing that efficiently, because it's a never-ending process. For me, almost 50% of the time is mixing, not composing, especially when it's all in the DAW. And yeah, it's such an important skill to learn to do it well, but also learn to do it efficiently. And for me, having somewhat of a system, I think helps increase the efficiency. So I know the logical order in which I'm going to proceed at doing things.
Lately, there's been a lot of talk about AI and neural networks and people training neural networks on artists, especially visual artists these days. There's all sorts of people talking about the ethical and moral concerns there. I don't care about that right now, but I'm kind of wondering, Jeff, if a neural network trained on you and your output, what do you think that AI would sound like?
Oh boy.
This is like the write your own epitaph question.
I think that the odd thing is that I can, it probably sounds like a little robotic when I'm talking, because I tend to be very logical, actually. Meaning, before I start composing, I'll write out the harmonic structures I think I might want to use and the melody and before the pen even goes to the paper. And I don't know what it would sound like. I know what the inputs would be. There'd probably be a category for melody. There'd be a harmonic category. There'd be a rhythm category, an orchestration category, and a form category, meaning the structure of the piece. Ideally, you could type in whatever you want and it would sound good, but I don't know how that would be. But I tend to almost be a little like that on my own, and then let the creativity fly after the logical mind has set the opening parameters, I guess. That's kind of how I do it. I know everybody's different. Sometimes I'll hear composers talk and it seems like they're totally going by creativity all the time. For me, I tend to lay the framework of meaning of the piece before I write it, very logically almost, and then try to operate creatively, and I'm forgetting which is the left brain or right brain, but you know what I mean, that after the logical structure is laid out.
That sounds fantastic. I've always aspired to a workflow like that, but I've never been able to do it. I've always said, right, this time I'm not going to noodle around on the keyboard. I'm not going to like noodle around on my bass or anything like that. I'm actually going to sit down and, you know, plan it out first. And then after that, I'm going to go into I'm going to properly separate this into phases of production. And it never works. It's just like, oh, I can't work like this.
Yeah, everybody's different. I think that maybe the college with atonal music and so on, because some of that can be so cerebral, I think that's probably what lent to it. Because so much of that is, it can be very analytical, and that must have a lot to do with it. That and taking music history courses where you're literally trained to analyze music in that way, I think that really just imprinted on me to do it like that. But
yeah. Also, I think that the genre that you're working in might have something to do with it. Like, for example, today I was doing, I'm doing a project scoring some music for a game trailer at the moment. And the brief, luckily, talk about previous accolades leading to a certain reputation of genre and specialization naturally and organically. For me, the brief here is for like 80s Italo disco, which as Vince will know, is right up my alley.
That's nice.
That's exactly the kind of thing that I like doing. But anyway, I was doing sort of like a sketch, so to speak, for the client, so that they could, you know, give me some direction on whether it's this kind of thing that they're after. And I was thinking to myself that, like, I was saying to my colleague who's our artist, I was saying, I wish that there was an equivalent in music for like a sketch, like you do when you're an artist, you sketch something and it's all rough and it's like, you know, pencil, and you know, it's very loose, but at that stage, because it's a sketch, you can change things easily. And, you know, as people who are experienced at looking at sketches, they can extrapolate from the sketch to the finished product and give you some direction based on a sketch. And I was saying that I wish that there was an equivalent for music, probably.
Yes.
For, you know, for orchestral composers, the equivalent is playing on a piano or notating something down. However, with something like, you know, Italo disco or like acid techno or like industrial techno or drum and bass or any of these kinds of electronic styles that I love producing, there's sort of a certain amount of production that has to go in before you can really convey that idea to somebody and they can give you some direction on whether or not it's the right kind of thing. And yeah, like I spent 4.5 hours doing this sort of sketch today and sent it to the client. I'm thinking the client may not like it at all. That's why I wish there was a faster way to do it. But with this style of genre, to get that energy and to get that feeling that, oh, it sounds like an 80s Italo disco track, a certain amount of production seems to be necessary to achieve that.
Do you do that or do you just temp it?
Those are great ideas. And I went to it was Game Sound Con, and we went to, which was just a couple weeks ago or so, and there was the company called Bleeding Fingers, which is founded by Hans Zimmer and I'm forgetting who else, but they specialize in TV music. He told me their process of doing demos for clients like that, though it's a bit more of a long form than what you're describing, but they'll basically compose a suite, meaning a 3 to 5 minute piece that has the melodies and the production style in it, meaning the kind of instruments or the synths or whatever. And it has nothing to do with what the actual TV show score will be, meaning it's not scored to picture. It's going to be a throwaway sample. Mm-hmm. But in that sample, the client will not only hear potential melodies that later can be variated for the characters and so on, but also they'll hear the production techniques and the sonic palette.
Like a vertical slice.
Exactly. And kind of what you're saying, I think there's only two ways to do it. One is, as Vince said, a temp score. And you can get temp scores for sonic choice too, meaning they may not like the melody, but they like the instruments. Or the other way is to custom compose, as you said, but try to keep the custom composing short, because it can be a kind of a time waste if you compose a lot and then they're like, we don't like it. But yeah, I totally agree. There's no way to demonstrate sonically without demonstrating sonically. It's like back in the, John Williams said he'd bang it out on the piano for the director. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it was an orchestra and it was always the same every time.
Right.
And can't do that with a hybrid score. Can't do that with a non-orchestra score. You must show with production. But yeah, to be efficient, I would say get their input early. I try to, in cases like that, I'll try to even ask if they have any temps, and then I'll make a shorter sonic demo usually. But
yeah, this is doing this kind of thing efficiently. This is what has led me to doing all this kind of mixing as I go along without using any plugins, just to go as fast as possible and just using volume and pan, absolute basics to sort of mix as I go along so I don't have to mix at the end of it.
Yes. And yeah, that's largely actually what I do too, because I find that if you get too lost in the weeds of the mixing, there goes the creativity and it becomes a mental reset to get back into it. And actually, in the end, takes you longer, I think.
Right. Yeah.
We've been going for a little more than an hour now. And so it's usually around this time that we wrap up, but we can't wrap up until we get through conspicuous consumption. And this is where we all go around and talk about what it is that we've been playing or watching or listening to lately. Alex, have you been checking out anything recently in new or old media?
Well, yes, I have a few things there. Last week I was in Germany. I was in a road trip in Germany. We were in Berlin, Dresden, Görlitz, which is a small town on the Polish border. In Dresden, we went to the famous Semper Opera and heard La Traviata, produced by the Semper Opera, the Dresden Berlin Opera Company, which was absolutely outstanding. So that's not so conspicuous, but that's some consumption. In Berlin, we went to a free jazz performance, which was ear-opening.
Wow.
I'm not such a huge fan of free jazz. I prefer, you know, things with more obvious sort of connections and strings to the past and to jazz heritage. But yeah, this performance was quite interesting. And also some Baroque music performed by a German Baroque ensemble of Zelenka, if you know, who's one of, I think, J.S. Bach's contemporaries. So that was great. And then as for games, I've been playing an excellent game that I highly recommend. It's an indie game called XO1.
Cool.
It's produced by actually, I think, two or three people from my hometown of Adelaide in Australia. And it's really, really good. It's kind of like Journey by that game company, obviously, meets Outer Wilds. It's like Outer Wilds Light. Kind of, with a splash of Journey. A very good sound, amazingly beautiful to look at, and just a very compelling, interesting game concept overall. So it's not expensive. It's an excellent indie production. Go out and grab it, XO1. So that's me. So let's go around the table to Mike.
Well, I continue to enjoy the show Andor, which I think is really the only good thing that's come out of Disney Star Wars, maybe that in a few episodes of The Mandalorian. It's hard to even call Andor a Star Wars show because it is tonally incompatible with the canonical Star Wars. Like, you cannot imagine Luke Skywalker existing in this universe. But if you get over that hump and you treat it like an alternate reality Star Wars, it's so well thought out. The dialogue is so intelligent. And so much love and care has been put into thinking about the world that it's just a really enjoyable experience. And it's become kind of a high point in my TV viewing. The score does not stick to the imagination or memory, but it is very, very evocative and competent. Interesting, I guess it's kind of a hybrid score because some moments feel very orchestral and others feel very electronic, as probably befits this particular flavor of storytelling. Looking at old school media, real old school media, I've discovered the fantasy novels of China Mieville, whose seminal books came out around the turn of the millennium. So I've been reading Perdido Street Station, which is a kind of an urban fantasy in a vaguely 19th century Victorian London-ish city full of grime and corruption, but with a couple of characters who harbor noble friendship and loyalty, and it's a nice blend of an oppressive world and likable characters. So that's it for me. How about you, Vince?
Oh man, I've been checking out some old stuff lately. So basically, I've been reconnecting with a couple of friends who made me aware just recently of a barcade here in Southern California that was only about 5-6 miles away, but I never realized that it existed over there. So I went over there and I've been playing some good old Street Fighter 3 Third Strike, which is old now. I still think of that as a modern-ish game. You know, it's okay. It's a 2D fighting game, but it's one of the later ones. No, it was released in 1999. This is a long, long time ago now. But It's been fun actually trying to play this game for the first time in years and realizing there's still some things that my hands can do in terms of the combos, the motions, but also a lot of times it's me just getting angry at myself for not remembering how to react to the other character when they're doing particular attacks and strategies. But I kind of want to get back into that. In terms of newer stuff, not too much in terms of games, but I have been checking out a little bit of The Rings of Power. And I'm not exactly the biggest Lord of the Rings fan, but I do really like it. I think the show is pretty good. I think the soundtrack is actually even better than the show itself. And that's Bear McCreary being very, very good. You can't be too surprised if you know about his earlier work. He's been doing a lot of stuff in TV and films and games for a while. The Rings of Power soundtrack is pretty great. So it is a recommended listen, if not necessarily a watch.
He gives a lot of emotional power to scenes that haven't really don't earned deserve that it. Power.
Yes. But it is really good.
The scene where they're kind of like the flotilla is leaving Numenor to go on this kind of poorly planned expedition. And he has this amazing stirring music that really just sweeps the moment along. And I was thinking, like, there's the scene owes itself to his contribution. He really is the heart and soul of a lot of that show.
Yeah, definitely. They're really glad to have him on board because it really pushes things forward. So that's it for me. Jeff, what have you been checking out lately?
Yeah, on the video game front, Elden Ring has been it's the sole game I'm actually focusing on right now because it takes so much time. Sometimes time's a bit limited. I just love the depth of the game, and in particular, the music is used very subtly in the exploration moments, meaning it comes in and it's very blended well with the ambience and things like that. I'm not the best player at it, so I'll admit that. I mean, I've been looking up ways to easy character level ups and things like that, but for that, that's been a lot of fun for me. Prior to that, I would often play casual games a lot, believe it or not. Like Stardew Valley was one I was into a lot and played a ton of, just because when schedules are tight, it would be easier for me to get into it. But I'm trying to now tackle a bigger game for that because at heart, I love games like that. It's just tricky to find the time for it. So I'm enjoying that. Recently, a couple weeks ago when I was in the Los Angeles area for the Game SoundCon conference, me and my wife went to a jazz show, which was great. Had been a long time since I'd been to a live jazz performance, so that was a lot of fun. And interestingly, the trumpet player was Mark Pender, who was the trumpet player for years with Conan O'Brien. Oh, wow. And I used to watch the Conan O'Brien show religiously pretty much every night. And I remember him being the butt of some of the jokes by Conan and things like that. So that was cool to see that guy right in front of us, basically. So that was fun. As far as film, I haven't been to too many films this year, but one of them I liked a lot was The Northerner, or The Northman, that's what it was called. Really intense movie, but I liked the score a lot. And I always like movies that are a bit off the beaten path, meaning they're willing to explore new themes. And they're not necessarily art house films, but they're not, you know, your blockbuster kind of formulaic things. I enjoy things like that a lot. Books. I started reading, I think it was back in 2018, a sci-fi film I watched that I like called Annihilation. I've started reading the Southern Reach trilogy, which that's been based on. So reading it at a snail's pace because I'm kind of hopping between things, but that's been a lot of fun. And one other thing is recently I haven't gone to many plays or theater, but I did go to one a couple weeks ago, again, when I was at Game SoundCon, just at one of the evenings there, it was called 222, A Ghost Story. So I haven't been to a lot of theater, but really at heart, I love all kinds of art. It doesn't matter what it is. When I was a youth, I would actually draw a lot, and I liked visual art a lot. So it's just fun to kind of revisit different mediums and things like that and get inspiration from them.
Fantastic.
I've been hearing about that. Actually, if you wouldn't mind, how was 222? I haven't heard much about it, but that was on my radar.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it tied in a bit with Halloween because obviously Ghost Story and things like that. It has a twist at the end, so they say don't tell anybody. So I won't do that.
Okay.
The acting was great. It was entertaining. It never appeared to be dragging or that kind of a thing. I'm not an expert on theater, so I can't give the appropriate critic review, but I enjoyed it a lot.
All right. That's awesome. Cool. Maybe I should actually buy tickets for that. It's just been on my radar for a while there. So that's something. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that there's some cool stuff there. And also, wow, I really am impressed just by how much you've been engaging with so much media and art lately. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm overwhelmed and I have to hide away from all the stuff that's out there in order to get my work done. But, you know, you've been doing a lot of stuff and you've been engaging in so much stuff as well. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I try to. I mean, I often am broad but not deep, meaning I will sample for things, but then it'll be a while before I get back to it. But that kind of goes into what we were talking about with the music stuff. My interests are so diverse that I truly love all of them. And, you know, I'll try to take advantage of it when I'm, like, for example, the jazz show and the play and things like that, when I was in the area and just looked some things up, kind of we just decided on the spur of the moment to go do it. So I'll try to be spontaneous when the opportunity presents itself.
So if you have an inclination to be broad, would you say that you have a broad bent?
Yeah.
Oh, oh God. On that note, no, thank you. Like, honestly, it's been really great having you on the show, Jeff. And, you know, before we head out, I just want to see, like, do you want to take an opportunity to plug anything that you're working on right now?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was really fortunate to be, there's a music awards show called the Hollywood Music and Media Awards. And I was lucky enough to be nominated for a couple categories this year. One of them was best video game trailer music, which was music I did for Riot Games, League of Legends, Wild Rift trailer, which was fun. And another one was best mobile video game score, which was for primarily a Korean video game. I did it with a company called Nexon. They're a big publisher in Korea, but it's called Heroes of Incredible Tales 2. And that was a main project I've been working on for the past year, actually. I'm still working on it a bit because the game has updates and things like that. So those are a couple really recent highlights that tie into the awards thing next week and things like that. Other than that, doing some additional music for some Wild Rift trailer that will probably come out this Sunday, and potential projects in the works and things like that.
All right. That's really cool. Congratulations on those nominations. And yeah,
thanks.
You know, I saw about that a little bit earlier, as well as listening to some of the music that's there from, why is the name escaping me?
Oh, that the Korean game you're talking about?
Yes, I was like, it's Nexon. Why is the name escaping me?
Yeah, Heroes of Incredible Tales 2. Yeah, it's
thank
a
you.
Long name. I see. Yeah.
Yeah, and you can listen to that to a lot of that score on your website, right?
Yeah, I have on my website. I try to keep it up to date. I'll do project pages where I put score samples to it, and I'll usually write a little commentary about kind of my thoughts when I was composing it and things like that. Yeah, that one's up there on the website.
All right. Yeah. That's that. Just said your name, right? www.jeffbroadbent.com.
Right. So
cool. Yeah. Thank you for hanging out with us on the show. And
yeah, it's been great.
Yeah. But
yeah, it's always fun to talk shop, talk art. I mean, I love it all. So video games, of course.
Yeah. It's great. But wow, it's already been well over an hour, and so we're going to have to come to a close now. So this was episode 232 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we will post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I just said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while we update all our gear with new firmware. Bye. It's true, though. Like, we have way too much new firmware coming in. It's like, oh, you hope that's going to fix an issue. I had to update the firmware on my speakers. And,
wow.
It's really annoying.
Your speakers have firmware?
The speakers have firmware. And the software,
terrifying.
Every time I turn on my computer, the software is going to say, hey, you know, you should update the firmware. And it's like, And if I don't do that, or if I don't remember to dismiss those things, they're not going to actually play sound. I'm like wondering, I'm trying to get to work right away. So
that's the Windows experience. The Mac experience is you don't have to do any of that until once a year there's a new operating system and everything breaks at once.
Yes. Yeah, that's always my fear. I'm still on 10.13 for that reason.
Smart man.
Yeah. But now I need to upgrade because the contact library.